Welcome back, everybody. Yes, last week we gave a broad kind of introduction to the ideas of Eruv. And today I want to start by talking about a specific Eruv. Specifically, the Eruv in St. Louis, which was the first recorded Eruv in North America. Now, you're not surprised to hear that when it got practical, when they actually started making Eruvin, that the first recorded Eruv in North America in St. Louis was actually divisive. It didn't unify in the spirit of Eruv, but actually was divisive. And it's that division and that argument that we need to talk about, and that'll hopefully kind of broaden our understanding about what Eruv is about and what it was like to be Jewish, to be Orthodox in America at the end of the 19th century. A little bit of background about St. Louis. By 1920, there were 50,000 Jews in St. Louis. Now you say to yourself, St. Louis? How did St. Louis get 50,000 Jews? Well, let's start like this. By 1920, there were about 2 million Jews in New York. Now, I think that explains why 50,000 Jews are in St. Louis and why there's a community in Toronto that we'll talk about next week. And that is that many Jews, you see, what happened was that when Jews immigrated to this country, beginning in 1881, there were anti-Semitic attacks beginning in 1881. Then by the beginning of the 20th century, there was the pogrom in Kishinev in 1903 that scared a lot of Eastern European Jews. Jews came to this country. Jews came to North America. And they came to New York, and many of them, most of them came to the Lower East Side. And it was hard to make a living in the Lower East Side. Literally, it was hard to make a living. The Jews who did a little better, I'll just tell you one sentence. My great grandfather came here in 1890. He was an itinerant shochet. What that meant was he traveled up and down the East Coast and he slaughtered animals for people in small towns up and down the East Coast. And, you know, that was a good job because he got out of New York so he could make a living. Being a shochet in New York City wasn't going to get you very far at the end of the 19th century. So the Jews who were able to went to other cities, went to other places. So it's not surprising that there are 50,000 Jews in St. Louis. Most of those Jews start off as being Orthodox, meaning when they came from Eastern Europe, they were Orthodox. They all live in a small neighborhood, what they call now downtown St. Louis. Then they called it the Jewish ghetto. There were 12 shuls there. There were Batei Medrash. You know, it was a good old-fashioned Jewish community. The one shul that's relevant to our discussion is a shul called Sheirit Svard. Now, you know that Sheirit Svard doesn't mean that there were Svardic Jews. The Jews all came from, you know, from Eastern Europe, from Poland and Lithuania and Russia. Svar just meant that the way in which they davened was Nusach Svard. And the people who davened Nusach Svard were generally those people who came from Poland, those people who had Hasidic backgrounds. So Sheirit Svard just told you, if you want Nusach Ashkenaz, go somewhere else. And Sheirit Svard, they davened Nusach Svard. And also not surprising, there was the main shul, and then there was a breakaway from Sheirit Svard. It wasn't a breakaway like sometimes you have a breakaway in another community because some of the Jews lived elsewhere. No, the breakaway of Sheirit Svard was all on the same block, South 9th Street, as the main shul. Obviously, there was some politics, which we don't know anything about, and there were two branches of the same shul. The rabbi of the breakaway was someone by the name of Rabbi Shalom Elchanan Jaffe, Rabbi Jaffe. Rabbi Jaffe was born in 1858 in Lithuania. He studied in the yeshivas of Lithuania. And in 1887, he moves to St. Louis. Seems to be that they put out an ad for a chief rabbi of St. Louis. Doesn't mean much. He was the only rabbi in St. Louis. But he comes to St. Louis in 1887. He doesn't do well. We don't know exactly what happened, but we know that he leaves St. Louis and he goes back to Europe. Can you imagine? It really didn't work out in St. Louis. He went back to Poland. In 1891, it seems to be it didn't work out in Poland either. So he comes back to St. Louis in 1891. He spends some time in St. Louis. Again, it doesn't work out so well. He moves to Brooklyn, where he has another fight, which isn't for now, but another interesting discussion. And he dies in 1923. So it seems to me that he's the perfect rabbi for the breakaway shul. Okay, he's kind of a rabbi, whoever he is, kind of controversy follows. The rabbi of the main branch of Sheretz Sfard is someone by the name of Rabbi Zacharia Rosenfeld. He's a little bit older. He's born in 1847. He comes in 1893 to New York and then to Baltimore. And then sometime around 1895, he also goes to St. Louis. And Rabbi Jaffe and Rabbi Rosenfeld lock heads on two issues, the mikveh and the eruv. The mikveh was built by Rabbi Jaffe and it was opposed by Rabbi Rosenfeld. The eruv was built by Rabbi Rosenfeld and opposed by Rabbi Jaffe. Whatever they did, the other one didn't like. It's interesting that they flipped, right, in terms of who did it and who opposed it. But that was the mikveh and that was the eruv. There is actually literature about the mikveh controversy. Again, it's no, opposed the mikveh. They don't oppose the establishment of a mikveh. Obviously, he thought that he didn't make a kosher mikveh for whatever reason. There is material on this. Obviously, it's not for us, but it is an interesting topic. Now, the back and forth about the eruv actually happened twice. And this is an interesting story. Rabbi Rosenfeld builds the eruv around 1894 or 1895. He does not write a book about his establishment of the eruv. We know about the establishment of the eruv because the opponent, Rabbi Jaffe, writes an entire book about his opposition to the eruv. It's called Shoel Ka'inyan. Here it is, Shoel Ka'inyan. Shoel Ka'inyan is published in Jerusalem, which is its own topic, in 1895. Rabbi Rosenfeld responds to Shoel Ka'inyan and he writes a book called Tikvas Zacharia, which I do not own. And then Rabbi Jaffe responds to Tikvas Zacharia with another book called Teshuvah Kahalacha, which is the back of this book, Shoel Ka'inyan. So again, Rabbi Rosenfeld builds the Eruv. Rabbi Jaffe writes a book opposing the Eruv. Rabbi Rosenfeld writes a book answering Rabbi Jaffe's criticisms. Then Rabbi Jaffe gets the last word answering the answers of Rabbi Rosenfeld. Okay, that's our background. What I want to look at today is three issues concerning the Eruv in St. Louis. One is Eruv boundaries. One is leasing the city. And for those people who weren't here last week, we'll talk about all of that again. And the third is the reason for the need to build an eruv. So the first issue is size of the city. We said last week that the eruv was introduced basically for the Jews in Roman Palestine who lived around a courtyard. So it was really a way to enclose a very small neighborhood. Then the Jews expanded and they were enclosing bigger neighborhoods and then entire cities. The rabbis realized that, you know, once you allow for an eruv, basically there was a question once why the island of England isn't considered an eruv since it's surrounded by water. So there has to be a limit to what you can enclose in term to make an eruv, to allow for count. So the rabbis in the Talmud explain that an eruv cannot be created if more than 600,000 people live in the area that you want to enclose. If more than 600,000 people live in that area, so then you can't build an A-roof around that area. Has to have less than 600,000 people. Obviously, that's going to be a big discussion when we come to Manhattan, but you'll have to come back in 2 weeks for that discussion. So the first question is, in 1895, are there 600,000 people who live in St. Louis? So Rabbi Rosenfeld writes that no, there are less than 600,000 people who live in St. Louis. He says, and you don't have to worry about the 600,000 people, because even the people who live there, you know, most of the people don't drive. Most of the people, don't walk. Most of them are on some kind of trolley or some kind of means of transportation. Therefore, they're not counted, because it only counts people who actually walk on the street. That was what my Rosenfeld said. So you can build an A-roof because there are fewer than 600,000 people, and most people are on means of transportation. Rabbi Jaffe says, no, there are 700,000 people in St. Louis. Now, what's interesting is, and this is going to be important again and again and again, Rabbi Rosenfeld and Rabbi Jaffe are rabbis from Lithuania. They had just recently come to the United States. These are rabbis who are Orthodox, who do not speak English, who are uncomfortable in the New World, have mixed feelings, as we'll see, about living in the New World. Their interaction with the world, with society, with knowledge about St. Louis is very limited. So you wonder, where does Rabbi Rosenfeld get his information from? Is where does Rabbi Jaffe get his information from? Obviously, they don't tell you. But I'm going to tell you an interesting thing. In Gould's St. Louis directory, which had the populations of St. Louis during this period, I'll tell you that in 1893, there were 574,000 people living in St. Louis. And in 1896, there were 611,000 people living in St. Louis. Why is that interesting to me? Hey, those rabbis were pretty close, which means they actually, even though they were Eastern European rabbis who didn't really like living in America, they clearly did their research. They didn't include an academic footnote in their books telling you where they got the information. But clearly they spoke to people, because the number of people in St. Louis was right around 600,000. That was a real issue. So therefore, they clearly both knew. Now, they explained it as suited them. For Rabbi Rosenfeld, it was just below 600,000. For Rabbi Jaffe, it was just above 600,000. Of course, they're gonna explain it in a way that's gonna help them. But it's interesting that they were pretty close to what the reality was. Now, okay, so let's assume that Rabbi Rosenfeld builds the Eruv. He is convinced that there are not 600,000 people walking on the streets of St. Louis. But you need Eruv boundaries. If you remember from last week in Cologne, they had Eruv boundaries. Generally speaking, the boundaries were created by the houses or the apartment houses that they had. And then they somehow cut off the street at the end of the street leading to the marketplace. What did they do in St. Louis? Again, the Jews are newcomers. They have no clout. They don't have political clout. They don't have economic clout. They can't go and say, and by the way, we'd like to put up some strings and some poles around our neighborhood to enclose our neighborhood. It's no big deal. We'll just put up the poles and we'll put up the strings. The Jews, they had no connections. They had no clout. They had no entree. That was impossible. So Rabbi Rosenfeld knew that if he was going to argue for an Eruv in St. Louis, it was only going to be an Eruv that was based on pre-existing Eruv boundaries. And therefore, Rabbi Rosenfeld gives the boundaries as follows. To the east and to the north, the boundary of the Eruv was the Mississippi River. To the south, there was a tributary of the Mississippi River, which also was a water boundary. On the west side of the Eruv, there were telegraph poles, which had poles and wires on the top, which connected the west side to the rivers and to the rest of the city. So imagine St. Louis being surrounded by the rivers and then by the telegraph poles. And Rabbi Rosenfeld said, that's our Eruv. That's our enclosure to allow for an Eruv in St. Louis. Now, the first thing Rabbi Jaffe says is, he says, you can't have Eruv boundaries that are not connected to the place where the people live. You see, the river was there, but the river was separated, of course, from the Jewish neighborhood. The telegraph poles were miles from where the Jews lived. Rabbi Jaffe said, that's not an Eruv. An Eruv needs to enclose the Jewish neighborhood. He said the Gemara, when it talks about an Eruv around a courtyard, you're enclosing the little courtyard where the Jews live. You can't tell me that somewhere miles away there are enclosures. That doesn't count as Eruv boundaries. Now that's very interesting, because that makes a lot of sense. Because the idea of making an Eruv means you're enclosing the area where the Jews live. If it's not actually enclosing where the Jews live, but it's boundaries miles away, what connection does that have to the Jewish community? But Rabbi Jaffe doesn't stop there. Rabbi Jaffe says, first of all, the rivers. Why is a river an Eruv boundary? A river is an Eruv boundary because there's a river wall, meaning where the river starts, it comes up to the dock, and there's a wall there where the river comes to the dock. Think of the Hudson on the west side of Manhattan. You have the piers, right? It comes up to the pier, and that's a wall. What he says, what Rabbi Jaffe says, is that the river, when it intersects with the city, doesn't always intersect in a place where a wall is created. Actually, he says, often there's sediment or there are other kinds of things, so that actually the water comes up to the ground, comes up to the land, and there's no wall that's created. So he said the fact that there's a river, this is also going to be important when we come to New York, the fact that there's a river doesn't automatically mean that the Eruv counts. You have to see, is there a wall that's created where the Eruv meets the dock, or where there is no wall? And he claims that there are not walls around all of St. Louis. Finally, he says, telegraph poles. Anybody who has ever seen an Eruv put up knows that one of the basic rules of Eruv is that the wire or the string must be connected to the top of the pole. It cannot be wrapped around the side of the pole. It has to be connected to the top of the pole. That's why, for instance, in the Hamptons, where they put up an Eruv, they put up small poles, so that didn't go all the way up to the telegraph, you know, to the telephone wires, but they put up small poles so that the wire was on top of the small pole. The wire is not allowed to wrap around the pole. Now, generally speaking, and we know this happens to be true, though we don't know exactly what it looked like in St. Louis then. Generally speaking, telegraph poles and then telephone poles, the wire is not connected to the top of the pole. Generally speaking, it's connected, and then there's a piece of the pole that goes above the wire. says Rabbi Jaffe, your telephone poles are no good. Your telegraph poles are no good because the Eruv wire actually needs to go on the top of the pole and it doesn't go on the top of the pole. So therefore he rejected the use of the telegraph poles as well. So Rabbi Rosenfeld argues that there are enclosures that surround the Jewish community, that enclose the Jewish community. And therefore, the community is enclosed and there can be an Eruv. But Rabbi Jaffe says each one of the enclosures is problematic. The rivers are problematic because they don't necessarily create a wall. The telegraph poles are problematic because the wire doesn't go on top. And generally, his enclosures are problematic because they tend to go, to be much too far from the community to be considered enclosures. Now, let's take a minute. Okay, and Rabbi Rosenfeld writes back and explains, no, the telegraph poles go on top and the river has a wall. And, you know, of course, it's hard for us to know what the reality was. That's a reality from 1894, and it's very hard for us to know exactly what the reality was. But that's really, you know, that's only part of the picture. What are Rabbi Rosenfeld and Rabbi Jaffe really arguing about? Of course, what they're arguing about is the following. Rabbi Rosenfeld believes there's a need to create an Eruv. The reason for it we'll get to in a minute. Now, if you need to create an Eruv, and I can't go to the government and ask them to put up poles and strings and wires, so I'm going to have to use what I have. Basically, we would say, I'll have to do the best that I can. And Rabbi Jaffe says the best that you can is not good enough because there are rules of Eruv and you're not meeting the rules of the Eruv. And Rabbi Rosenfeld says, yes, I am. But Rabbi Rosenfeld is stuck because if you tell him that the Mississippi River can't count to surround two sides of the Jewish community, well, then there's not going to be an Eruv. So Rabbi Rosenfeld says, I need to use what I have. And Rabbi Jaffe says it's not good enough. That's an interesting debate. And that is, how do you deal with a reality when this is the best that you can do? And there's no alternative. There's no, I can do better. They weren't in a situation where they could do better. That's why, of course, the story of the Eruv pre-1970 is a completely different story than the Eruv post-1970. Because post-1970, when the Jews all of a sudden started to be more influential, they had some clout. They could do better. And therefore, the conversation is different. But pre-1970, they couldn't do better. If you can't do better, what do? Rabbi Rosenfeld says, we're going to make do with what we have. And Rabbi Jaffe says, no, you can't. There are rules of Eruv. And you need to follow the rules of the Eruv. That's the first piece of that controversy. The next piece of the controversy is leasing the city. Remember that we go back to the courtyard in Roman Palestine. If you have a courtyard and there are two Jewish houses and one non-Jewish house, so then you need to lease the house of the non-Jew for the purpose of the Eruv, so that it'll be an Eruv community. Okay. Now, that was fine when there was one house to lease. What did they do when they were leasing neighborhoods and cities? So we saw at the end of the class last week that they used to lease the space from a government official who had, in a sense, authority over all of the houses in the city. And the Shulchan Aruch says that's what they did actually in Constantinople, where they leased the space from a representative of the Sultan. Actually, it's interesting. He tells us that the Sultan was concerned. He said to one of his assistants, are the Jews trying to take over the city? That's ironic because the Sultan took that leasing of space more seriously than the Jews did. But the question was, what were the Jews going to do in St. Louis? Going to the mayor doesn't seem to be an option for them, right? Who's Rabbi Rosenfeld to go to the mayor? Doesn't seem that he had any connections or contacts to the mayor. Doesn't seem like that's an option. So Rabbi Rosenfeld says the following. He says, actually, in America, too, the governmental authorities have the right to enter people's houses, to, you know, to issue warrants, and based on those warrants, to enter people's houses and to, you know, to check the houses for whatever they're looking for. The fact that they have the right to enter people's houses shows that they have a certain authority to over all the houses, since they have an authority over all the houses. So therefore, you can rent the space from the governmental officials who can issue these warrants. But that's not helpful for him, because he can't get to those governmental officials. But then he takes it one step further and he says, no. And who, if there is a warrant, who actually enters the houses? The police enter the houses. They issue a warrant. The police enter the house, get whatever they want or look for whatever they want. And they have permission to do that and they cannot be stopped. Based on that argument, says Rabbi Rosenfeld, you can lease the space from a policeman because he has the ability to enter any house based if he has a warrant. And since he has that authority, he has that is what the Shulchan Aruch described, and that you are allowed to lease the space from such a policeman because he has the right to enter the houses. Brilliant. Why is that brilliant? Because obviously the only person who has authority, who Rabbi Rosenfeld has any connection to, is probably the local policeman. You know, you could imagine that they gave him a gift. I don't know whether it was a monetary gift or a bottle of schnapps, and they leased the space for him. They say, listen, hey, we'd like to lease the space for you. Here's a dollar. Can we lease St. Louis from you? Can we lease the Jewish community? And Rabbi Rosenfeld, brilliantly, I have to say, avoided the problem. He found the policeman. The policeman was, you know, he was his friend. They leased the space and the Eruv was complete. Now, what does Rabbi Jaffe say? Rabbi Jaffe actually makes fun of Rabbi Rosenfeld's use of the policeman. And let me just share the screen with you here. So, Rabbi Jaffe says the following. The scholar who permitted the Eruv was very proud of his discovery. And he asked some of his people to give something to a policeman. They gave the policeman something to satisfy him. And he sold him the authority for the entire city. Means they leased from the policeman the whole city. And he added in a joking manner that he was also selling them Chicago, right? The policeman said, okay, I'll sell you St. Louis. I'll also sell you Chicago. This is true. For he had just as much right to sell Chicago as he did to sell St. Louis. In addition, no official has the authority to remove someone from his home, even if it is in the public's good, without paying the inhabitant of the home. This is not what the permitting rabbi wrote, as he does not know the truth. Yet this is known to every child in America. Furthermore, all the rest of his arguments are useless words. For even the officer who is called a detective can only enter homes against the will of the owner in a case of suspected robbery, but not for other reasons. In addition, there is a problem, because the policemen are replaced every year. So he makes a couple of points, all interesting points. The first point he makes is he makes fun of them. Okay, he makes fun of them. He says, you're telling me that you're leasing St. Louis from the policemen? The policeman joked he was going to sell you Chicago too. The truth is that he could have sold you Chicago, because the same way he can't sell you St. Louis, he could also can't sell you Chicago. So first is he makes fun of him. That's always, you know, that's always kind of enjoyable. It's enjoyable when you see where the rabbis, you know, that's their kind of sharp sense of humor. He's critical, but he's critical by making fun of him. But then Rabbi Jaffe actually argues, interestingly, about the rights of policemen to enter the house, right? Do policemen have the right to enter your house? And he says, no, policemen don't have the right to enter your house. They only have the right to enter your house if there's a robbery. And they can't throw you out of your house unless they pay you for your house. So what are you telling me, that there's this sense of eminent domain, or there's this sense that the policemen can do whatever they want? It's just not true. And then he makes a last point, which is that, you know, this is kind of a Talmudic point, but it's an interesting point. You lease the space from the policeman, Policeman Joe. But policemen change all the time. Policeman Joe's not working next year. It's Policeman Charlie who's working next year. So you need to rent it, to lease the space from a new policeman. You're not doing that. You leased it once and you're not leasing it again. Now, what interests me here is that in this case of leasing the space, it's not like the question of the boundaries. When it came to the boundaries, Rabbi Rosenfeld said, I have no choice. I have to use pre-existing boundaries. And he uses pre-existing boundaries, whatever the pre-existing boundaries were. Whether they're good or not good, they were pre-existing boundaries. When it comes to leasing the space, he's got to interact with somebody, because you need to lease the space. And he wasn't going to knock on every door of every non-Jew in St. Louis and lease their space. So clearly that he was going to lease the space from somebody. So if he was going to lease the space, how is he going to do it? He needs to interact. So what Rabbi Rosenfeld figures out is, I need to find somebody who has authority, who I have access to. That person is a policeman. And Rabbi Jaffe says, that's ridiculous. The policeman has no authority. You're just making that up because he's the only person you have access to. So here you have a very interesting, you have really, in a sense, a very primitive argument about how to interact with American governmental authorities by rabbis who have no access to those authorities, right? Today, we lease the space from the mayor of New York City, from the mayor of Toronto. It's no big deal. They're dying for a picture, for a photo op, right? To be able to show everybody that they're helping out the Jewish community. You may have seen the New York Times last week. There was an article about the Eruv in Brooklyn, and they went to the borough president of Brooklyn. Of course they went to the borough president. And he was very, very, very proud to lease the space. But this is 1895 in St. Louis. They have no access. What are you going to do? Rabbi Rosenfeld said, I'm going to go to the policeman. And Rabbi Jaffe said, you're making that up. That is ridiculous. The policeman has no authority. It's interesting that Rabbi Jaffe doesn't seem to argue with the idea of Eruv. He seems to be very fine. He doesn't say, you can't make an Eruv. We'll get there in a second. He doesn't say, you can't make an Eruv. What he says is, Rabbi Rosenfeld, you are not making a kosher Eruv. The boundaries are no good. You're leasing the city from the policeman is no good. You have not created a kosher Eruv. So it could be, if we stopped here, we would say that it's a good old-fashioned legal argument, what we would call a halakhic argument between the two. Rabbi Rosenfeld believes that his boundaries are boundaries. His leasing from the policeman is a lease. And Rabbi Jaffe says your boundaries are not boundaries and your lease from the policeman is not a lease. Okay. But of course, that wouldn't be very exciting. What are they really arguing about? That's what you always want to know about rabbis. What are they really arguing about? Are they arguing about whether there's sediment in the Mississippi River? Are they arguing about whether the Telegraph polls actually, whether the wire goes on top of the poll or goes around the middle of the poll? Is that what they're arguing about? Are they arguing about whether a policeman can enter your house or can't enter your house? Or are they arguing about something else? And it, both Rabbi Rosenfeld and Rabbi Jaffe help to allow us to know what they're arguing about by including a short introduction to their books. And I want to read a piece of the introductions, which I think you'll find very interesting. Rabbi Rosenfeld writes in his introduction, "I arrived in this nation and I witnessed even many of the religious Jews carrying on the Sabbath. A religious Jew is not embarrassed to carry his tallit in public and to wear it in the synagogue. I said to myself, what should I do for the sake of my people to remove this terrible sin? If I raise my voice like the shofar to decry the severity of the prohibition, I know that my words will not make an impact because people have already become accustomed to carrying on the Sabbath. In addition, the preachers in this country have already set the standard of raising their voices, stamping their feet, clapping their hands, and shaking every limb in their bodies to criticize the actions of the people. Yet they have been unsuccessful and their words have been ignored. If I get upset and embarrass the sinner, I will have nothing to my credit other than my anger. I therefore have decided to return to the word of the law and to look for a way in which the Jewish tradition would allow for carrying on the Sabbath. When I was appointed rabbi in St. Louis, I continued my search and I found a correct and acceptable way to permit carrying on the Sabbath." This paragraph is among the most amazing paragraphs written in the history of the American Orthodox rabbi. What Rabbi Rosenfeld said is the following: "I came to St. Louis and all the Orthodox Jews are not really Orthodox, right? They carry on the Sabbath. I don't know if they're not really Orthodox, but they carry on the Sabbath. They're not careful about carrying on the Sabbath. What should I do?" Rabbi Silverberg, right? You're a rabbi and the Balabatim carry on Shabbos. What are you supposed to do? So he says, the other rabbis in the country, you know what they do? They scream and they yell and they stomp their feet. And you know what they have? You know what they get out of it? They get a hoarse voice. That's all they achieve. They get a hoarse voice. They accomplish absolutely nothing. So screaming and yelling is not going to get me anywhere. They're used to doing it. They don't think there's anything wrong and they continue to do it. So what am I going to do? What I'm going to do is I'm going to see if I can build an Eruv, create. He's not building it. He's creating an Eruv. Because if I create an Eruv, then these people will not be in violation of the prohibition of carrying on Shabbos because they'll be an Eruv. They might not even know that there's an Eruv, but they won't be in violation of carrying because there will be an Eruv. Now, this is an amazing argument. It's an amazing argument because today, the reason you build an Eruv is for the people who want to observe Shabbos, who want to not carry on Shabbos, who will not be able to carry if there's no Eruv. And if you have an Eruv, they won't be able to carry. It's for the Shabbos observers. But in 1895, it wasn't that. He didn't have any Shabbos observers. He didn't have any Shabbos observers. And therefore, his people were all Shabbos violators, at least in terms of carrying. I don't know what else they did. I know they walked to shul because he saw them carrying their talis walking to shul. So they were walking to shul, but they were carrying their talis. And Rabbi Rosenfeld says, I need to take care of these people who are Shabbos violators. And the way to take care of people who are Shabbos violators is to build an Eruv. Wow. The purpose of the Eruv is to save Shabbos violators from violating Shabbos. To save the people who are carrying their talis to shul and will not listen to me screaming and yelling, to save them from Shabbos violation. That's the reason to build an Eruv. Actually, that's a pretty sophisticated kind of argument. Sophisticated in the sense that it understands the reality, right? He understands what the reality is, and he understands that his role as a rabbi is to help his people religiously. Sometimes you help them by telling them not to do something. They couldn't put a lechi on every pole because you need permission to put the lechi on every pole, and they didn't have permission. They couldn't get permission from the government. So he understands his responsibility as a rabbi is to help his people, even if they won't even know they're being helped. But, you know, we usually think helping the people means to do something that makes them feel good. Here, it's helping the people in heaven, meaning that they're going to get a check next to their name for Shabbos observance rather than Shabbos violation, because they're not going to be violating Shabbos because they'll be in Eruv. So even though they carry, they won't be in violation. Where there's a halachic way, there was a rabbinic will, there's a halachic way. I mean, you can say that. I mean, and well, leave aside Blue Greenberg for a second. Because of that, Rabbi Rosenfeld feels that he needs an Eruv. And Rabbi Rosenfeld feels that he needs to find Eruv boundaries and to be able to figure out a way to lease the community. He needs to do that. He needs to do that for his membership. Did he inform the community? I guess he probably did, but it didn't make any difference because they were carrying anyway. So if he made an announcement on Shabbos, they say, oh, very nice. But they're carrying anyway, whether the Eruv is up or the Eruv is down. Now let's see how Rabbi Jaffe responds to Rabbi Rosenfeld. Recently, a rabbi has come to St. Louis and has permitted carrying on the Sabbath with made up arguments that have no basis at all. Worse than that, he has built an entire structure on these arguments, one that permits carrying on the Sabbath in all American cities. Notice, Rabbi Jaffe did not permit carrying in all cities. But Rabbi Roosevelt did not permit carrying in every, he just permitted carrying in St. Louis. But Rabbi Jaffe makes it bigger. Furthermore, violators are rampant in this generation. And those in America hang on to his coattails and argue that it is preferable to be permissive. And this matter can easily become a plague in the cities of America. For what will prevent other rabbis from permitting that which is prohibited merely to gain the favor of the masses? Furthermore, some have claimed that this rabbi will allow them to keep their stores open on the Sabbath through the sale of the store to one of their non-Jewish employees. Indeed, some people who are concerned about the money that they are losing on the Sabbath are asking me to permit their stores to remain open, just as this rabbi has done. The Sabbath is thereby violated even by those who consider themselves religious, and the essence of the Sabbath will be forgotten. Now, the first interesting thing in Rabbi Rosenfeld's response, so Rabbi Jaffe's response, sorry, to Rabbi Rosenfeld, is that they agree about the religious status of the people in St. Louis. Both Rabbi Rosenfeld and Rabbi Jaffe agree that the people, their balabatim, the Orthodox people in St. Louis, the people who go to the Orthodox shul, are Shabbos violators. On that, they agree. Rabbi Rosenfeld said that because they're Shabbos violators, yeah, of course they're overall observant. They come from observant homes. They daven in an Orthodox shul. They walk to shul. Of course they're observant. For whatever reason, they carry on Shabbos. They didn't think that was a violation. Who knows why? But absolutely, they are overall observant. Eric, they're only interested, the rabbis are only interested in the Orthodox. Those are their people. They're not interested in the non-Orthodox. Now, Rabbi Rosenfeld said the people are not Orthodox. I have no choice but to build an Eruv. Rabbi Jaffe says the people are not Orthodox. So the first point he makes is that Rabbi Rosenfeld made up his arguments. Okay, we went through that already. We know that's not the real issue. What is he worried about? What he's worried about is the spirit of permissibility. If we basically tell the people that carrying is permitted, they're going to think that everything is permitted on Shabbos. You see, Rabbi Jaffe's view of the American Orthodox are that they don't want to really be observant. That, Eric, they're holding on to what they had in the old country, but they don't want to really be observant. So there are two choices. One choice is to be tough. Tell them you're wrong. You're wrong. You need to be observant. And even if they don't listen, but at least they're hearing that what they're doing is wrong. So at least they'll know it's wrong. And what Rabbi Jaffe says by Rabbi Rosenfeld is, you're telling them it's okay. You're not only telling them that carrying is okay. That's no big deal that you're telling them that carrying is okay, right? There's an Eruv. But you're giving them the impression that they can do whatever they need to do to get around, that loopholes are okay. So if they need their store open on Shabbos, just sell the store to a non-Jew. So they've come to me too, asking me for that, you know, for that workaround to allow their stores to be open on Shabbos. And he says that the spirit of permissibility is only going to be destructive to the Orthodox community in America. That's what he argues. So what are Rabbi Jaffe and Rabbi Rosenfeld, what are they really arguing about? And I think what they're arguing about is how to deal with the Orthodox in America. These Eastern European rabbis come to America. Exactly what the reality was in Eastern Europe, the grass is always greener on the other side. So they imagine that everybody was perfect in Eastern Europe. Everybody was a Shabbos observer and everybody followed the laws and nobody carried on Shabbos. Everybody did exactly the right thing. We understand that. They come to America and they find an Orthodox community that is not as observant as they want them to be. What do you do? Rabbi Rosenfeld says the following. I want to include as many people as I can within observant Orthodoxy. That's going to be good for Orthodoxy in America. I want more people to be part of the community. And therefore, by building an Eruv, those people who are carrying on Shabbos, first of all, God won't be angry at them. But more importantly than God won't be angry at them, they will be part of a community that we can consider Orthodox. And on some level, they will appreciate that even though they were going to carry anyway, now they're doing it in a permissible fashion. And therefore, they are part of Orthodoxy. To put it another way, what Rabbi Rosenfeld believes is that Orthodoxy in America at the end of the 19th century will be strengthened by enlarging the box of Orthodoxy, by including more people within the box of Orthodoxy. Because the more people I can include in the box of Orthodoxy, that'll be better for Orthodoxy going down the road. Because if I can, as many people as I get in the box, so I can hold on to more people. So therefore, what I need to do is I need to enlarge the box. In this case, how do I enlarge the box? I enlarge the box by building an Eruv. So more people now are part of the box of observant orthodoxy. Being permissive enlarges the box and allows more people to be in the box, and that's good for orthodoxy. Rabbi Jaffe says, absolutely not. I'm sure they didn't give public classes on Eruv. Rabbi Jaffe says, absolutely not. We are Orthodox rabbis. We can't worry about enlarging the box. We need to preach observant orthodoxy based on the letter of the law. The box is the box. If you're willing to follow us, then you're in the box. If you're out, if you're not willing to follow us, you're outside the box. And I'm only interested in that solid group that finds itself within the box. It may be smaller than the group that Rabbi Rosenfeld wants to attract, but my group is more committed. And I would rather have an orthodoxy that's smaller and more committed than an orthodoxy that's just looking for permissibilities all over the place and is not really following the letter of the law. In a way, I would say that Rabbi Jaffe is trying to reestablish the orthodoxy that he believes he left in Lithuania and Poland. He wants to have that kind of very strict orthodoxy. And that's, if you don't fit into that box of orthodoxy, you don't fit into that box of orthodoxy. And what, that's it, you're not orthodox. Rabbi Rosenfeld is much more of a realist. He may not have any access to the government officials. He may not be able to ask him to put up strings and poles. But he understands the psychology of the American Jew at the end of the 19th century. And he understands that these American Jews are being pulled by America, by the Golden Medina, that it's going to be a struggle for orthodoxy. It's going to be a big struggle for orthodoxy going forward. And what he needs to do is he needs to hold on to as many people within the box of orthodoxy as he possibly can. And if what that's going to require is that he's going to broaden the box, and he'll be permissive, and he'll allow for Eruv boundaries, even though the Eruv boundaries are not so clearly halachic. And he'll allow for leasing the space from a policeman, even though it's not so clear that that's allowed. In the bigger picture, that's more important. Because in the bigger picture, what's important is to expand the box, to make sure more people fit into the box. Because the more people who fit into the box, the better it's going to be for orthodoxy. That is, I mean, that argument basically defines the first half of the 20th century among orthodox rabbis in America. Do we preach a very narrow, rigid orthodoxy and say we're only interested in the few who will follow our rules, everybody else who cares? Or are we willing to expand the box? And by expanding the box, we have a better chance to hold on to orthodoxy in America. I can't tell you which answer is right and which answer is wrong. They argued about that then, and now they don't need to argue about that, because now you can be any flavor of orthodoxy. There are as many flavors of orthodoxy as there are of Haagen-Dazs ice cream, right? So now this is not an issue. But you understand that when orthodoxy struggled, this was the major issue. And this issue played itself out in the argument about the Eruv. I'm sure Rabbi Rosenfeld agreed with Rabbi Jaffe that his Eruv boundaries were not perfect. I'm sure he agreed that it would have been better to lease the space from the mayor and not from some policeman who we met on the corner. I'm sure he agreed, but he understood that the future of orthodoxy in America required a certain leniency that he was willing to take upon his shoulders. Rabbi Jaffe said, absolutely not. We cannot introduce that leniency. And he explains why. Because if you give them a finger, they take a hand. He didn't know that phrase, but that's what he meant, right? If you give them a finger, if you give them the Eruv, if you tell them that the Eruv is okay, then they're going to keep their stores open on Shabbos. And we're going to see that in Toronto, that's a big problem also. You see, if you allow them to carry, where are they going to carry? They'll carry to their stores and they'll keep their stores open on Shabbos. So he says that whole slippery slope, we call it today, will be created because of these leniencies. We need to be strict and we're only interested in the people who follow these rules. Let me just take a minute, and I see there are a whole bunch of questions, so let me just I'll take it from the front. Oppose the mikvah, but power lines are above poles, aren't they? So some of the, we don't know, first of all, they're not power lines, they're telegraph poles. We don't really know what they look like. Only a judge can authorize the search of a home. That's correct. That's what I said. Means, you know, they kind of were redefining what the law is. I think the Mayor Adams celebrated the Brooklyn era boasting it was created by the police when they leased eminent domain. Am I correct? Was Mayor Adams correct? So I don't know. I mean, Mayor Adams, who was the borough president of Brooklyn, was very much excited about the Eruv. And the, you know, the Jews in Brooklyn who have been working on this Eruv for a long time, they were dealing with borough president Adams before he was mayor. So he was definitely excited about that. Rabbi Jaffe, much more correct on the America law point. The warrant can issue only in probable cause. I mean, we said that, right, Eric? I mean, that's correct. Rabbi Jaffe is correct. Rabbi Rosenfeld is making these things up. But again, we now understand it because he feels that there's no alternative. Why could they put a lech on each pole? We said that already. Blue Greenberg, we talked about her already. Did he inform the community that, I guess he informed them. They may have been overall observant to a considerable degree, but just neglected the carrying prohibition because the opposite of the Eruv, they couldn't function, women and children. Yeah, Eric Levine. Thank goodness for Eric. So Eric raises the question of women. Women do not come up at all in this book. Women do not appear. The first time we're going to see women is in the New York Eruv. They don't seem to be worried about the women. The truth of the matter is that in Europe, they used an Eruv basically because they didn't have ovens that they could leave on overnight. They used to put the chullent in the baker's oven. And they used to have to carry the chullent from the bakery to their houses on Shabbos morning. That, Eric, is what they were worried about. The men wanted their chullent. So it's interesting that you're right, of course. And the women's issue is a huge issue. And the article in New York Times about Brooklyn talked all about the women, right? But that wasn't their issue then, which is fascinating. Slippery soap. We talked about, do either rabbis hold public castles in the neighborhood? We don't know, but I would imagine not. Would either Roosevelt or Jaffe have used the word Orthodox? They don't have know about Orthodox. They're Eastern European. They're Shomer Mitzvahs, but it's the same word, you know, that for our purpose is the same word. What if Amcha doesn't know? What good does it do? So the answer is Amcha knew. He told everybody there was an Eruv. And they were part of the Orthodox community. What viewpoint dominated the 20th century? So that's a good question. I would say that the more liberal view dominated. And that we'll see is true in a minute. Manhattan Eruv, that's what the reason Orthodoxy survived is because there were rabbis in the middle of the 20th century who were willing to be more permissive and to include people within Orthodoxy, right? That's the Ramaz philosophy, right? That they, you know, that you have a school, which is an academy, but it's still considered Orthodox. I mean, that was a whole philosophy that goes far beyond Eruv. So the answer is there were rabbis that represented both viewpoints, but I would say, Eric, that if you have to, you have to choose, you probably would say the more permissive wins. Too bad they didn't publish books in Roman times, remembering your first year when Jews found themselves living mixed with the Goyim. I wonder perhaps a similar argument took place. So, yeah, so that is correct. Means they didn't talk about any of those kinds of things and what it meant to live with the non-Jews. It didn't seem to matter. They just needed to find someone who could lease the space from. As Eric pointed out correctly, Rabbi Jaffe's right legally. I didn't get involved in that because that's not what they're worried about, right? We may look back at that and we may need a lawyer's interpretation to know who's correct, but they didn't know about any of that stuff. Rabbi Rosenfeld was interpreting it because he needed to interpret it in that way, because otherwise he wasn't going to have an Eruv and then before he was going to have a problem. Anyway, the first Eruv in America, St. Louis. There's a lot here. It's fascinating. Look forward to seeing you all next week. We'll take you over the border and we'll talk about Toronto. Shabbat shalom, everybody. Be well.
Thank you.